Thank you and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, to another episode. I won't claim an exciting episode. I realize that you sometimes claim an exciting episode.
I do, and I think it's exciting because for 2 hours we have the opportunity in live, real-time radio to screw things up massively and hurt ourselves indefinitely.
All right. So welcome again to another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach. It may only be exciting for us, though.
Jake and Jeff.
What? Starring Jake and Jeff McClure. Yes, your mic cut out a couple of times because for some reason my microphone is the alpha microphone, and if I breathe heavily, your voice doesn't come through, which is maybe most sons' dreams about talking to their fathers, but I actually like a equal and open dialogue. We'll have to figure that out.
Yeah, but you're the chief compliance officer, which means that you should be able to cut me out.
Right. So this is the Personal Wealth Coach. This is Jake McClure. On the line with me is Jeff McClure. The Personal Wealth Coach as a radio program is intended to give you all kinds of good news and education on what's going on in the market, how to make decisions better, what's happening in the world on the economic front, what are the threats, what are the opportunities, or at least some of them. It is also the name of an investment advisory firm registered with the Securities and Exchange Commission. That doesn't mean that they have given a thumbs up or any form of approval to the firm. It's just the regulatory authority. The firm, the Personal Wealth Coach, rather than the radio program, the Personal Wealth Coach, the firm gives fiduciary investment advice, which is absolutely impossible to do over a radio without violating all kinds of privacy concerns. Because in order to give investment advice at a fiduciary level, we actually have to know the person that we're talking to. In fact, there's a rule for it called know your client. It's a regulation. So what you're hearing on the radio is educational in nature. We're trying to share our knowledge and our mistakes that we have made and that other people have made so that hopefully you don't have to make them too. You want to take the next disclosure?
We don't pay for this radio program. On the other hand, KTM has to do the radio program.
Right. So we're not paid and they're not paid.
We do advertise on KTM. That's actually all we're supposed to disclose.
Yes, we do advertise on KTM, but our advertisement is for the radio program.
That's cool.
Yeah.
And the information we provide on this radio program is obtained from sources we deem to be reliable, but we neither warranty or guarantee the completeness or accuracy of said information.
You can say, did you say warranty or guarantee, or did you say warrant or guarantee?
Warrant or guarantee. I don't know what I said.
I think you said warranty and guarantee.
Well, that sounds fun. I don't know. We don't warrant or guarantee. That's right. I modified it. The accuracy or completeness of the information, but we do deem the sources to be reliable.
Yes. And if we talked like that all the time, nobody would want to talk to us.
Oh, yeah. Lawyers.
Lawyers would talk to us, only we wouldn't understand them either. And that's the thing. We would speak back and forth. We'd both feel like we were making our points really well, but neither side would understand the other.
Well, the lawyers understand that when you say that. They know what a tort is.
I think it all needs reformed. If you talk to people about tort reform, they think you're talking about something that's served at a Tex-Mex restaurant. Yeah, I like mine curled up. No, not a tortilla. Not a tortilla. All right. So what happened this week in the market?
Let's see what happened in the market. The stock market, and we use the S&P 500 as our measure of this, but we'll talk about another index here too. We didn't have much of a week, really, because Friday was only half a day and Thursday was only half a day. So we had a 3.5 day week, no, a three day week actually. And so the market rose 2 points, the S&P 500 stock index, the specific version of it, the SPX, rose 2.27% for the week, which is a lot. And it closed out a new record and that means it's up 12.62% year to date. Now, this is important. Up 12.62 year to date is really good, particularly in a year where the U.S. will almost certainly have a negative GDP. How much is anybody's guess, but after the fourth quarter comes in, we still won't quite be up to where we were last year. But the stock market rose 12.62%. And here's the important point, at least to me. 10 points of that are since the election. Yeah. And the reason that's important is there are news media sources that proclaimed with great authority that the stock market was going to crash after the election. Now, it depends on which news media source you were watching or listening to.
Well, we heard both sides. One side would said, if Joe Biden wins, the stock market was going to crash. And the other side said, if Donald Trump wins, the stock market is going to crash. But usually after elections, the stock market doesn't crash.
And the stock market, at least now, why the stock market rose 2.27% in this week, which is a lot. If you multiply that times 52, it would mean a tremendous number. And the stock rise more than 100% in a year. So
the reason why you use the number 52 is because that's the number of weeks in the year.
Right.
Yeah.
So the reason that was reported by the Wall Street Journal and Jake asked me a good question. How do we, Mike? I don't know, it's Jake. I don't know if it was you or my wife who asked me.
Your wife?
My wife.
Well, yeah.
Who asked me, how do you know why the stock market is going up or down? If you say.
Yeah, it wasn't me.
What happens is the reporters of the Wall Street Journal kind of do a survey of the brokers who do direct trades on the floor, the traders who do the direct trades on the floor or electronically on the New York Stock Exchange, and they kind of do a survey each week, actually each day. They kind of call around and say, why were you buying today or why were you selling today? Because if you're buying, if there's a lot of buying going on, the market goes up. If there's a lot of selling going on, the market goes down. And they kind of take a consensus of what the traders are saying. And the traders are saying two things that are very important. One, it looks like we have three vaccines that might work. Yes, sir.
Oh, there's a confusing thing in here that before we get into the technical what's happening, to address her question more directly, how can you have more buying and selling if by definition, if you're selling, someone is buying? This is a good question. For us, we take it for granted that people understand this stuff. But when we talk about that, that question makes it sound like an intense logic puzzle. How can there be more selling causing the market go down when by definition, in order to sell, someone has to buy? So how could there be more selling than buying?
Well, actually, there's not more selling than buying, but there's more selling pressure or buying pressure. In other words, when more people line up and say, I want to sell my stocks, then the price tends to go down. When there's more people wanting to sell stocks than there are wanting to buy stocks, the price goes down until the two come together.
Right. When people say, hey, I don't mind buying at that price, then
it levels off.
Right. Okay.
Anyways,
so go ahead.
A couple of things. Obviously, the new vaccines, we had the third vaccine that looks like it might be approved, except for the fact that they kind of screwed up the test, so they're going to have to do the test again, so we don't know whether it's going to work very well or not. But the other thing is, and I know this is going to make some people unhappy to hear, and it's going to be contrary to what other news media sources have been saying, the other thing that made the market, which is the consensus of the people who buy, the traders who buy and sell on the market on a daily basis, is Joe Biden's cabinet picks.
Yeah.
Two aspects to this. One, his cabinet picks have shown to be moderate. Janet Yellen, as Secretary of the Treasury, is a very, very popular choice. She's a very moderate, apolitical person. She doesn't have an axe to grind. She's very independent, and she's going to pursue things and she has the education to know what works really, really well in the economy and what doesn't.
Right. She was in the line to be repicked by President Trump, for chairman of the Federal Reserve. And she kind of quietly said she really didn't want to do it anymore. The head of the Federal Reserve is traditionally apolitical. which means that they try to stay out of politics. They may have an opinion about stuff, but they're too busy looking deeply at the numbers and the finance world to really care about what the major social events are that are going on. So they tend to be very, very academic in their approach. Go ahead.
Basically, what's happening is Mr. Biden, or Senator, well, not Senator, he was a senator at one point, vice president at one point, and now he's president-elect, at least we think he's a president-elect, is making speeches and making appointments, and they seem to be very, very moderate. They don't seem to be extremists. They seem to be people who are far more interested in the financial system functioning well than they are in any political goals.
And this has not made the progressives in the Liberal Party very happy. But they're dealing with it because they see this as a better alternative to a conservative appointing only conservatives.
The other thing that's important that happened this week in the markets, well, there's several things, but another thing that's important, at least in symbolic terms, is the Dow Jones Industrial Average midweek closed above 30,000, which is the highest it's ever closed at. Of course, it promptly dropped back to 29,910.
Which is not that much lower.
Not that much lower, but we missed the symbolic measure. By the way, that's a tradition. For whatever reason, it's the way it normally happens, is when the Dow hits some kind of round figure number like 10,000 or 20,000 or in this case 30,000, people promptly sell off. A lot of people sell because they said, I'm going to hang on to this set of stocks until the Dow hits 30,000, then I'm going to sell. And there's no reason for that, but people do it anyway. And it's important that the Dow hit 30,000 because the Dow has lagged behind the S&P 500 this year, and it's catching up, which means that there's stocks other than the 5 or 10 stocks in the S&P 500 that are driving the train. They're extremely high growth stocks, large cap growth stocks that are priced in many cases at an unreasonable level. And the Dow tends to be more value oriented, although they've put some new, now they've put some different stocks in there over the years. So it's a little more tech oriented. But it's good to see that the Dow is finally trying to catch up. The other thing is we follow something called the CRSP US Value Index.
Right. There are other people that use Russell 2000 or some of the other indexes that are looking at the RUT. This is our preferred one.
And that's the Center for Research on Securities Prices, by the way, CRSP. The U.S. Value Index is a mid-cap value index, and we kind of like to look at that because it's not large cap. And it rose 2.74% to 2,022.87. Now, why is that important? The Dow was up, obviously, the S&P 500 was up, but the mid-cap value index was up more, which means the market is continuing its rotation from large-cap growth into smaller-cap value, not at a great rate of speed. It's not knocking the ball out of the park, but the market is becoming a little more sane is what that means. We've been concerned because there are several large-cap stocks, large-cap growth stocks, that you're probably familiar with, Alphabet and Google and Facebook and Microsoft and so on, that are priced at ridiculous levels. Amazon, they're priced at ridiculous levels versus their earnings. And it looks unrealistic that their growth will continue at the rate they have seen in the last year when they've run up so much. Why is it unrealistic to continue that kind of growth? There's only so many people that can buy Microsoft Windows. There's only so many people who can buy Zoom. There's only so many people who can do this. And Amazon's big surge in profitability and revenue has a lot to do with the fact that there is a pandemic going on.
Right. So I would expect this Christmas to be really kind to Amazon. But that doesn't mean that I would expect the same thing next year. In fact, I would expect the opposite next year. Not that it's bad. It's just not going to be as good as it is this year.
The point is that historically, at some point, when we've seen a market like this that is dominated by a few large cap growth stocks with unrealistic, what we believe to be unrealistic price to earnings ratios. In other words, their earnings simply don't justify the price that they've got. Eventually, this corrects. And generally, when it corrects, it's unpleasant and scary. because there's a sell-off in the market. And we hope that this won't happen this time, but I've hoped that it won't happen this time so many times, I've come to the conclusion it's going to happen at some point. So be prepared for it. Now, it's not anything disastrous.
Although people that jump out, that think that they're going to make a huge amount of money, jump in at the very top and then jump out at the bottom, it's disastrous for them.
And we keep hammering on this, and we keep talking about it. We've been talking about it for some time. And it gets kind of old, and people get kind of tired of hearing it. But just as we talk about when the market is in the pits, when we've had a market crash or a big downturn in the market, a bear market, we talk about hang in there because this will end, and we'll see a bull market on the other side, and it'll be higher than the previous bull market because it always has been, and the economy keeps growing. Well, the same thing is true when you've got a peak in the market like we have today. This can't go on forever. Now, when it's going to end, sometimes it goes on for years. Alan Greenspan quoted the title of a book, Irrational Exuberance. He says, how do you know when it's irrational exuberance, and how do you know when there's something fundamental has changed? Well, that was in 1994, and it was 6 years later before the market started correcting. So it can go on for quite a while, but the wise thing, we believe, is to keep well diversified and not chase the market.
Right. We have a question in our email. And if you would like to ask a question, just as a side note, you are welcome to. We have email addresses at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. tpwc.com is the personal wealth coach, or Tango Papa Whiskey Charlie. And we already have a question. The subject line of the email is Janet Yellen. She's up for a new position. What are the main responsibilities and differences of the Fed chair and Treasury secretary? So we alluded to that just a moment ago, that Janet Yellen, former chair of the Federal Reserve, has been selected for Joe Biden's pick to go before the Senate to be approved to be his Secretary of Treasury. And the question is, what's the difference between what the Fed does and what the Treasury does, and specifically what the Fed chair does and the Treasury secretary? The Federal Reserve, through an act of Congress, very originally called the Federal Reserve Act, set up the Federal Reserve to regulate banks and to protect the currency against inflation and deflation. We've since added some more responsibilities about employment, keeping that stable, and trying to stabilize markets. But those two are really difficult things to do from a banking perspective. They have to have lending programs and a lot of other things that are only there as temporary rules. The Federal Reserve's job is to scrutinize the buying power inside the United States of the dollar and to change interest rates to make money easier to get or harder to get, more expensive to get. Where the Treasury Secretary is in charge of a whole series of other things, including advising the president on who the president should appoint as a Federal Reserve chairman. The absolute number one position of any cabinet person, secretary, is to advise the president on their given area. The defense secretary is going to be advising on defense. And when they have a cabinet meeting, that's why they're supposed to be picked, because they have a great deal of expertise in that area. Now, the Treasury does a whole bunch of other stuff, like collect taxes. The IRS is under the Treasury Department. In fact, when you write your check to the government for your taxes, you're not writing it to the IRS, you're writing it to the Department of Treasury. They print money there, but they only print money when requested by the Federal Reserve, because the Federal Reserve is supposed to be in charge of how much money we have in the money supply. They say, hey, we're running out of cash, print some more cash. Cash is a minuscule portion of the overall money supply. I mean, if you think about how much money you have available in a credit card versus how much money you have in paper form in your wallet, you'll see and understand very easily that there's a lot more electronic money in existence than printed money. So that role is a lot less important than it used to be. It's still important. What are some other big things that I missed there? There's a lot of stuff together. The political aspect, They the Treasury Secretary often is the head of negotiations when meeting with Congress, both the Senate and the House, to say this is what the president is trying to accomplish in the budget, or this is what the president's trying to accomplish with tax reform or tax raising, tax lowering, any of that stuff.
A big role of the Secretary of the Treasury is to control the Treasury market to the best of his ability. Now, the Federal Reserve gets involved in that, too.
Right.
Treasury market is where the United States goes out and issues new Treasury bonds, notes, and bonds, notes, and bills to borrow all the money that the United States spends, the government spends, but we don't have in tax revenue, which is a lot.
A lot.
Trillions of dollars. And he's injecting, he's actually exporting money.
He or she.
He or she.
In this case, it would be a she.
That's right. What's a good word for that?
For what? Non-gender specific?
Yeah. The various secretaries of the Treasury have a major role in.
There's a good word for it. The secretary.
The secretary. Well, madam or Mr. Secretary has a big role in controlling how we borrow money, and that is a major, major, major issue. For instance, if we go out and borrow a lot of money using 10-year Treasury notes.
Right.
If he tucks all the borrowing that we're going to do in a given week or a given month into 10-year Treasury notes, the interest rate on the 10-year Treasury notes will probably rise substantially because that's just the way it works. He's dumping a lot. When interest rates rise, the value of the underlying notes go down. When you dump a lot of supply into the market and the demand isn't there that much, then the value would go down. And it would, so he can affect interest rates rather dramatically simply by where the United States borrows money in terms of maturity.
Right. So what does that mean? If the secretary decides to borrow in the long-term market at low interest rates, you can wind up flooding the long maturity 30-year area and causing interest rates to go up because there's not enough money to borrow out there sometimes. So they have to juggle that.
An important point here, and it's a little controversial, but it's reality in our opinion, is that we don't have a trade imbalance.
Right.
In other words, we're importing more than we're exporting because one of the major things we export is Treasury securities. We manufacture Treasury securities every month, every week in many cases. And people from outside the United States, the majority is bought inside the United States, but a lot of it is bought outside the United States by foreign governments and banks and individuals. And every time we manufacture a Treasury security and we sell it to them, that's an export, but it's not counted in the exports. And if you actually look at the trade imbalance and you throw in the amount of money and not amount of money, the amount of value that we export in terms of Treasury securities, because we manufacture them and sell them to the rest of the world, we actually have a trade surplus each year, which is why, despite the fact that for about 40 years, we've gone with supposedly a massive trade imbalance, which if we really had a massive trade imbalance where we were importing far more than we're exporting, we would be bankrupt at this point and our economy would have collapsed. Instead, we have arguably the most healthy economy in the world. So we are obviously exporting something to balance it out. And if you look at the Treasury securities we export, you see that's in the dollars we export. I know that sounds a little strange, but for example, China buys its raw materials around the world and it needs a lot of raw materials using dollars. That is not, it's money, certainly. But it's a product that has value that's manufactured in the United States, and the Chinese use to buy ore. They buy copper ore and gold and iron and all and oil and all the things they need using a product that we manufacture in the United States, and the Treasury is responsible for manufacturing that product.
I think that's absolutely correct. That product and the quality of that product falls in the purview of Congress, who has to pay back the debt, but also the executive department. This is one of those things. When we have budget shortfalls or where the government shuts down because we can't agree on the budget. And different Treasury secretaries come forward at these different times, like Mnuchin was the last one who said, hey, we have extra controls in here. We can extend it beyond the normal limitation by just continuing to do what we're doing. What are those controls? Well, there's some money that's already been released by Congress for other things that stated by Congress will fall back into the general fund if it isn't spent. So if the Treasury Secretary doesn't spend it on one thing, it falls back into the general fund and they can spend it on other things. There are also borrowing capabilities that the Treasury Secretary has. When Congress passes a law that raises the debt ceiling and they've agreed we're going to spend this much money on this stuff, but they haven't released new revenue to do it with, then the Treasury has to borrow money. That's their job. This way back at the beginning of the country, there was a law that was passed that says we're going to spend this much money. If that was more money than we had available to spend, another law was passed at the same time. A sister act would come out with that law that says we are going to borrow X amount of money and the Treasury is authorized to do so. Well, Congress got lazy and said, we don't want to do that anymore. We're just going to, every couple of years, sometimes a couple of times a year, depending on how fiscally tight they're being, we're going to raise the debt ceiling. Well, that gives a lot of power to the Secretary of the Treasury. They get to borrow the money as they see fit to pay for the bills that are being driven by Congress. That's how it works. So it's a big job. The Federal Reserve Chairman is a big job, but it's a very focused big job. They're looking at just a very tight area, but at a level of intensity that is really hard to describe to people. It is granular. They're looking at the economy and the currency very, very, very closely. The Treasury Secretary has a much broader look that has a lot more to do with what the government's trying to accomplish with the money that they're spending rather than just keeping the money supply under control.
Yep.
Hopefully that answered the question well without overdoing it and boring too many people. I think it's interesting.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the market. There are other markets besides just the stock market. The U.S. Treasury market, the 10-year note yield, which generally tends to go up when the traders in the Treasury market anticipate a better economic future, it rose with about a 2% increase yield, 0.846. Now, it's important to recognize that 0.846 is still only half what it was yielding a year ago. In other words, Treasury yields are abnormally low. So if you don't believe that yields are abnormally low, go to the bank and try to buy a CD at anything that even approaches 1%, you'll find out it's impossible. No matter how long you want to leave the money with the bank, they're not going to pay you very much because interest rates are low, which there's a whole economic reason for that. It's above the half to three quarters percent where it's traded for most of the year, but it's still amazingly low. Oil prices were good. And I don't like, it's kind of weird. They rose 8% to $45.52 per barrel for West Texas Intermediate crude. Again, the rise appears to be largely because the oil market is anticipating with the advent of the vaccines and with the new Biden administration, we're going to have a good economy probably beginning in the second half of this year. So people are willing to buy oil now, buy futures and store oil now. In anticipation of a better economy.
We have a whole bunch of other stuff to talk about as well. That storing and buying of oil in anticipation of a better economy is very clear. We're also seeing a big demand from China right now. China's importing more oil than it ever has. A big chunk of that oil comes from us. Is that even the right way to say it? Do you call it a chunk of oil?
I would say a large volume, but I've never seen a chunk of oil.
that there's a large chunk of oil being purchased by China from the United States. They're also buying from Saudi Arabia and Northern Africa and other places, but that their demand is helping to rise the price. We're also seeing more travel going on. You know, there's a lot of stuff out there to talk about, but like we do every week, the biggest thing to talk about is the pandemic. What were you going to say?
Well, the airline travel over the holidays is actually up to almost as high as it was last year, which is amazing considering that we have a pandemic going on.
Right. So that's another factor in the price of oil is that people have, you know, we've said this back in March, that the tough point is going to be right around Thanksgiving for the pandemic because it's not going away between now and then, and people are going to be sick of being socially isolated and they're going to want to see their family. Well, we're seeing that. And so what that means is that we can expect the pandemic to get a lot worse before it gets better.
And the problem, one of the things I think we may have lost sight of, one of the primary reasons that we're not assembling and that the government is asking us to separate ourselves and that we're doing all these things, supposedly doing all these things to limit the spread of the pandemic, is to keep the hospitals from being overwhelmed. We've got anecdotal information from people in the local area that the hospitals, local hospitals, are actually full where they don't have any extra beds, which is not a good thing if you get sick. In Austin this week, hospital officials were saying they were very, very concerned about the fact that they were going to wind up with more patients than they had hospital beds. They already have that situation in West Texas. Same thing is happening in Houston. They're not filled up yet. The ICUs are not completely full. The hospital beds are not completely full in Houston, but they're very concerned. And the reason they're concerned is they're seeing this big spike in coronavirus infections all over the state and all over the country. And what happens is it takes a couple of weeks from the infection to you start seeing the people going to the hospital. And right now in the United States, we have an absolute record number of people with COVID in the hospital. And the COVID, the COVID infection rate is rising dramatically across the United States. The hospitalizations are rising. And once you see the infection rate, it's a couple of weeks to see the hospitalization, and the infection rate tends to run up about 2 weeks after we see a lot of people getting together for something. And right now, over this week, we've seen a lot of people getting together, which means we'll probably see a higher COVID infection rate in about 2 weeks, and then about 2 weeks further along is where we anticipate having a potential crisis in the hospital. There's another crisis coming financially, in economically, that may affect the market, but I'll pass it over to you for something else if you want for a moment.
Yeah, when we're talking about these picks for Treasury, there's a whole series of other cabinet positions that were laid out by the presumably president-elect Joe Biden. In laying out those picks, the moderates were very strong, but the reality is that even though it's been a good week in the market, it's been a good week leading up to Thanksgiving, and I would actually expect to see some good news, surprisingly good news, on what's spent over Christmas, just because the vaccine news is out. The difficulty is that the news is here, and it's telling us this: there's good news on the horizon, but the horizon's farther away than we think it is. You alluded to this at the opening of the program, that the AstraZeneca-Oxford trial is going to be repeated. There's a series of other pharmaceutical companies that have already released their study data on the vaccine. It's likely to be approved and will likely get them out there. And they're already beginning to establish shipment routes. Transportation Authority is authorizing airlines to carry more dry ice than usual. How's that for a weird change of subject mid-sentence? What does this have to do with that? Because there's a limitation on how much dry ice you can carry in an airplane, particularly a passenger airplane. And a lot of passenger airplanes are going to be used to carry dry ice that's used to keep vaccines cold, because United has a big charter agreement with now two different pharmaceutical companies to carry their vaccine. So the logistical side of what, how are we going to spread this thing around? The leading vaccines are two-dose vaccines, which have to be separated over multiple weeks, sometimes as long as 6 weeks separating the different injections. That means that even though it's on the horizon, it's not flipping a switch to get this thing to go away. Economists are already talking about talking to Congress about paying people to get vaccinated, not just paying for the vaccine, but literally paying someone to get the vaccine. One of the ideas I saw touted was a $1,000 check to get the vaccine. Well, why is that? Because there's still a large number of people in the United States who are absolutely refusing the concept of going and getting this set of shots, that still don't believe that the pandemic is real. So why would they accept these shots that could cause fill in the blank medical whatever that they found on Facebook, you know, the third arm growing from the forehead or whatever? These are not seriously well thought out fears, but then fear is generally not usually well thought out. So how do we incentivize people to get this thing? Because the longer it's hanging around, the more and deeper and worse the impact on the economy. This is something that I'm going to do it. I'm going to stick my foot in my mouth. Here I go. If there's a single cause to why the sitting president lost the presidency, as close as it was in the Electoral College, why did he lose? If there's a single reason, it's because of the way the pandemic is not being treated well. He's trying to concentrate on the economy, and this is a good thing. Obviously, we're economists. We think the economy is a big deal. But it's like trying to concentrate on the health of your engine when all your tires are flat. Your engine might be in great shape, but you're not going to go very fast until you get your wheels fixed. The reason why the economy is slow right now has very little to do with government shutdowns. Yes, there are some government shutdowns and restrictions in place, but when we look around at, you know, 778,000 unemployment claims last week, that's a big deal. That's nearly, I mean, it's 750,000 people that got laid off. Well, that wasn't because the government said shut down your businesses. That was because people aren't going out and shopping because they're afraid to get sick, and people aren't going out and doing and spending the way they used to do because they're afraid of getting sick. That's not a government shutdown. So to address the actual damage to the economy, rather than just trying to allow the economy to figure it out, that requires some leadership. And if there's one reason that the president didn't get reelected, I think that's it. He had a big focus on the economy and on the market and on taxes, but he lost the focus on the fact that this virus, just like a hurricane or a big snowstorm, is going to slow the economy unless it's dealt with quickly and really, really harshly. And I realize that's, it's not a popular thing, but if he'd done these unpopular things back in April, he'd be looking at really good economic data today. And I mentioned that to someone, and they said, well, what are you talking about? The whole world is having a second wave right now. And I agree. Yes, they are. But the reason why the wave is as big as it is because we kept the population of the virus high in the United States. In Europe, they dropped it down. In Asia, they dropped it down. South America and North America, we just let it kind of rampage.
South Korea, which has a democratic government and is not a semi-dictatorship and does not have the authority or the or exercise the authority that we've seen in some of the dictatorships like China. The news this week was that they had 500 new coronavirus cases in their entire country, and they have a pretty big population. We've done a very poor job in the United States of managing the coronavirus. Maybe it's because of our culture, and maybe it's because of our national leadership, but it certainly didn't work out very well. And that has caused a problem. And that problem shows up in the economy. We're seeing this new rush of, there's two things going on that are damaging the economy, potentially damaging the economy. We're actually starting to see it happen right now. One is we're having a record number of coronavirus cases. And as people who previously were acting just like there was no coronavirus and they were buying things and selling things, know somebody who maybe has died or somebody who's become extremely sick from coronavirus, it suddenly affects them and they realize it's real. And they begin to back off and they begin to isolate and they begin to reduce their economic activity. We're seeing that happen in the United States. There's two things going on. One, the coronavirus, the expansion of coronavirus, and two, the fact that Congress has not passed and the president has not signed a new relief bill. It's really not a relief. It's called a stimulus bill. It's not so much a stimulus bill as it is a disaster relief bill, such as when very similar what happens when we have a hurricane in the United States or an earthquake in the United States, which we haven't had a big one in a long time. But the point is that the economy is starting to slow down. And we see that because for the first time since July, we've had 2 weeks where the layoffs, the number of new claims for unemployment have risen. Now, they're nowhere near the millions that we saw earlier in the year, but Jake mentioned that, that we were well over 700,000 new claims for unemployment.
778,000, yeah.
So we've got a lot of new unemployment claims coming in, and it's rising, which indicates things are slowing down. The other thing that came out this week that I think is very important is that the average personal income in the United States dropped 0.7%
right
in October. So we're starting to see a decline in personal income. And why is that? There's a lot of people unemployed in the United States, and the numbers vary, but it's somewhere between 10 and 20 million. We know that there's 12 million people that are on unemployment, extended unemployment, federal unemployment benefits. That's beyond what the states do. And that's scheduled to end in December.
Yeah.
And it's coming, and they don't have any prospects for a job, and so they're beginning to back off.
The number of people collecting unemployment benefits from the normal, regular, not souped up, not pandemic level, but normal unemployment programs fell to 6.1 million from 6.4 million. Well, that sounds great. 300,000 people not on unemployment anymore. That's good news, except that they didn't fall off there because they got hired. They fell off there because they reached the normal end of unemployment, which, you know, it's a really good idea for states to limit how long people normally have unemployment, because you don't want people just living on unemployment forever. But at the same time, in a disaster situation where unemployment rates in certain localized areas are still in some cases in the 30% in certain neighborhoods where you basically have to move to get a job, that's a very real thing right now. That's what we're seeing in the drop in personal income. Consumer spending rose at the same time. How's that for chaos? The fact that we have personal income dropping at the same time that personal expenditures are going up. People are spending more money but making less. Does that sound like a long-term good thing?
Well, what happened is people have increased their spending, well, 0.7% for the month, but no, 0.4% for the month, but their income fell 0.7, which means that we are in a position where that spending is going to fall off. I mean, it's almost a certainty. One of the reasons that the spending apparently went up, and incidentally, at least anecdotally we're hearing, is that credit card use is considered to be consumer spending without regard to where it was spent.
Right.
When we look at the statistics that are gathered by the government. However, there's anecdotal reports that we got out of NPR and some other places that indicate that a lot of people have started paying their rent with their credit cards. And that's not real consumer spending. That's normally not consumer spending, but we've not seen rent being paid with credit cards since the Great Recession in 2008 and 2009. Matter of fact, we didn't see a lot of it then, but we're seeing it happen now. So the possibility, the real possibility exists if Congress in the lame duck session does not pass a stimulus bill and the president signed it, and the chances of that happening are pretty slim.
They've got 2 weeks to do it, and that means that the House and the Senate, which have since March not been able to do anything together, have to come up with something to move forward.
And if they don't pass that and the president doesn't sign it so it doesn't become law and we don't flush a bunch of money into the economy to give to people who are unemployed, then we have the really distinct possibility that come the first quarter of next year, we will see us slide back into recession. This could have an effect on the market. We'll have to wait. It's a wait-and-see situation because the market is ignoring the economy right now. But at some point, something will happen that will cause the people who are buying it tremendous multiples to wake up and start selling. And speaking of waking up, it's about time we did some commercials.
Yeah, we're running a little late on the commercials. Tony, would you play some commercials for us? We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you'd like to ask questions, our emails in here are jake@tpwc.com or jeff@tpwc.com. We've got another one when we come back. Until then, thanks for listening, and we'll be back on the other side of these commercials. The Personal Wealth Coach with
Jeff
and Jake McClure. Welcome. Welcome back. What was that?
I don't know if we said that together.
We didn't, because you can't say things at the same time I am. Remember, it mutes you.
Right.
So you can all just assume that we said our names together. That's a good assumption. Yes. All right. So we have another question.
We do.
Did you see that?
I did.
Yes. It's about the 60-40 rule, and the 60 divided by 40 with quotes around rule. In today's world, is there a different percentage for retirees? Well, let's first talk about what that 60-40 is. Do you want to take that?
Well, traditionally, through, quote, normal, end quote, times, the 60-40 rule meant that your portfolio, as you a moderate portfolio, had 60% stocks in it and 40% bonds. Unfortunately, that doesn't work anymore. And it was considered to be moderate because the bonds would typically rise when the stock market fell, and the bonds would fall when the stock market rose, and you still have more growth-oriented, which is the 60% in equities. You'd still be more growth-oriented than you would be preservation-oriented. Like I said, it doesn't work very well anymore.
Yeah, and when it worked was really in very short periods of time. So in the 1980s, it really took off as the way to do it, is because we had interest rates dropping, which meant that you had an appreciation return on your bonds. So let me time out here for a second. This is one of those things, the conundrum of the finance world. Why is it that when interest rates drop, values go up in bonds? Why is it when interest rates go up, values drop in bonds? It's like a seesaw. What's going on here? It's supply and demand. It's just one extra variable in there. But if you think of the interest rate as what it costs to borrow money, that's really what it is. If there's a lot of money available to borrow, then interest rates will be low because the people that are trying to loan the money are competing with each other. No, we want this customer. No, we'll lower our interest rate. Well, where did that money come from? If it's a bank, it's because a lot of people are leaving their money in the bank because they want it to be safe. So if you have a lot of people putting their money in the bank, they want it to be safe, interest rates fall because there's a lot of money available to be loaned out by the banks. If you have a loan that you gave somebody that has a high interest rate, it becomes more valuable when the other loans that people are selling around you have low interest rates. Because would you rather buy an investment that's paying you at a 6% or buy an investment that's paying you at a 2%? More people want the 6%. I know, it's shocking. It means that as interest rates rise, loans that have low interest rates, nobody wants to own them because they want to own ones that have high interest rates. And as interest rates fall, nobody wants to own the new debt. They want to own the old debt. So if interest rates are falling for a long period of time, you get this appreciation value to the bond that isn't traditionally there. It's not there all the time. It's only in a lowering interest rate environment. Well, we're about as low as it goes. We could hang out here for a while, but that doesn't give a great deal of appreciation to existing bonds either.
20 seconds.
And if we go the other direction, interest rates go up, then the value of these bonds goes down. And we're about out of time this hour. If you'd like to call us off the air, you can call locally at 254-947-1111 or 800-914-PLAN. Go to the webpage.